Nuclear radiation contamination. Yes, it happened after the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. And it exists in other areas around the world, especially those downwind of nuclear bomb test sites. You might think that the choice of locations for detonations in New Mexico, Nevada, the Marshall Islands, French Polynesia, and the like happened without conscious plan. Until you hear a genuine expert, an historian of nuclear technologies and radiation technopolitics, and he tells you,
looking at the nuclear test sites, obviously the first thing that comes out, as you said, was that the communities that are selected to be irradiated are essentially communities that cannot politically keep this from happening. So test sites are located in colonial, post-colonial places or near ethnic or religious minorities. These communities that were selected to have these sites be upwind from them, each nation that made a choice of where to put the test sites used a similar kind of decision-making, which is, how can we keep this fallout away from people who are important? That's another way of saying, who isn't important? That's a chapter called Selecting the Irradiated.
Well, when Professor Robert Beau Jacobs of the Hiroshima Peace Institute and author of the book Nuclear Bodies, The Global Hibakusha, points out the environmental racism inherent in not only dropping atom bombs on the Japanese people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but everywhere we continued to test and manufacture these weapons of mass destruction, you get yet another glimpse at what's behind decisions made about that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, as we sadly commemorate the United States dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, we take a look at the long-lasting impact of radiation on people around the world. Be it from bomb tests, to uranium mining and refining uranium, to manufacturing weapons and nuclear reactor fuel rods, to the perpetual mishandling of radioactive waste, we have all been hit with nuclear radiation. That includes you and me. No matter where we live, if we're on Earth, we've been exposed, though some people in locations received much worse doses than others. That's what we learned from Professor Robert Beau Jacobs of the Hiroshima Peace Institute. He's the author of the superb 2022 book, Nuclear Bodies, The Global Hibakusha, where he lays out the case for all of us being radiation survivors. In other words, as I say on this show, we are all in the nuclear hot seat. The book is fascinating, lucid, powerful, and profoundly written, and it deserves to be in the library of anyone who opposes nuclear, and hopefully those who support it will read it as well and be convinced to change their minds. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information that has yet been mentioned by any of those seeking the 2024 U.S. presidential nomination. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 1st, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out with a look at the major story of this upcoming week, as Linda Pence Gunter in The Hot Story asks, did the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki end the war? Or was it a fundamentally immoral act of racism?
As we commemorate once again the U.S. dropping of atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the debate about the necessity or not of these immoral actions will doubtless resurface. The prevailing view, although it has been convincingly disputed, if not debunked, is that the bombings ended the war by forcing Japan's surrender. Thus, those who espouse this view argue, American lives were saved. However, communications among Japan's top military leaders later reveal that they were largely unfazed by the Hiroshima bombing. The earlier firebombing of Tokyo had done more damage and killed more people. They were even split over surrender after the bombing of Nagasaki. But wherever the truth ultimately lies, arguably one driving factor could well have been racism. A truly abhorrent propaganda campaign demonizing Japanese people as effectively vermin was launched after the Pearl Harbor attacks, making the atomic bombings justifiable and acceptable in the minds of the American public, along, of course, with the argument that the bombings were necessary to end the war and save American lives. Today, the posters and rhetoric in circulation then would be considered abhorrent hate speech, but in the 1940s, it instilled enough revulsion in the American public to justify the annihilation of at least 200,000 human beings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It also eased acceptance of President Roosevelt's executive order to intern predominantly West Coast-based Japanese Americans in harsh and remote concentration camps. If they could make no arrangements for the dwellings and possessions they left behind in the 48 hours they were given between the order and their transportation to the camps, these were lost to them permanently. Notably, there was no such prior interning of German, Austrian, or Italian Americans. Only the Japanese were seen as a threat, unfounded though these prejudices were on all fronts. This demonizing and othering of the Japanese was only the beginning. Soon, the newly emergent atomic powers were ready to test their weapons of annihilation, and they chose indigenous communities far away. The Americans bombed the Marshall Islanders. The British targeted Aboriginal lands in Australia and the islands of Micronesia. The French went to Algeria and then Polynesia. The Soviet Union chose Kazakhstan. And they mined their uranium from indigenous lands as well. Of course, it's not an entirely racist story. Atomic veterans have struggled for recognition of their suffering and compensation for years, largely unsuccessfully. And citizens of Nevada and surrounding states in the path of radioactive fallout from the Nevada test site were shocked to learn that their own government was willing to treat them like guinea pigs. The United States has never officially apologized to the people of Japan or the Marshall Islands or those in its own country, nor has France or the United Kingdom. Instead, it was a delegation of indigenous Diné from northern Canada whose community had mined the uranium used in both the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, who traveled there many decades later to apologize, even though their own community was known as the Village of Widows. A lesson in healing and reconciliation for us all. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
A new study has found that nuclear fallout from the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on July 16, 1945, reached 46 states and crossed into Mexico and Canada within just days of the detonation. Researchers sought to examine the fallout from nuclear tests in New Mexico and Nevada between 1945 and 1962. More than 101 atmospheric nuclear weapons tests were conducted in the United States during that time, which led to environmental contamination and exposed people to radiation. The report says that of the 101 atmospheric tests, 94 generated mushroom clouds. Physicists and doctors underestimated the reach of atmospheric nuclear explosions, and national systems to track such things were not in place. Researchers now believe that the limited understanding of the nuclear fallout had consequences for people seeking compensation from the government under the 1990 Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act, or RECA. We will have the map that shows the spread of radiation from Trinity on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 632. Much more attention is being paid to RECA and to those who qualify for it who have been thus far excluded. On July 27, the Senate approved a measure that would, for the first time, give health care benefits and compensation to communities in New Mexico that were impacted by the Trinity test of the first atomic bomb. Amendment to the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act will now include citizens from North St. Louis who live in proximity to Coldwater Creek and the Bridgeton landfill, both of which are contaminated with World War II radioactive Manhattan Project waste. The Oppenheimer film has increased attention to Native people and the damage they have suffered because of exposure to radioactive materials, specifically through uranium mining, through the Church Rock spill of radioactive waste into the Perco River, and the ongoing legacy of uranium mines that have not been cleaned up. The Oppenheimer film failed to make any mention of the Native people first displaced and then exposed to the radioactive fallout without warning from the Trinity blast. Navajo Nation President Bu Nigren said of the film, "The Navajo people cannot afford to be yet again erased from history." He called America's push to build the bomb an accomplishment built on top of the bodies of Navajo men, women, and children. In Massachusetts, regarding the plans of decommissioning company Holtec to dump radioactive waste from Pilgrim Nuclear into Cape Cod Bay, the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection has issued a draft determination stating that Cape Cod Bay is a protected ocean sanctuary under the state's Ocean Sanctuaries Act, which prohibits dumping industrial waste into protected state waters. A coalition of local, state, and federal activists have resisted Holtec's plans to discharge the wastewater, voicing concerns over safety for people who go in the water, ocean wildlife, seafood that comes from the bay, and the South Shore and Cape Cod's tourism industry. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
When it comes to numbnuts this week, there are so many to choose from. There's the nuclear-powered rocket that's proposed for space to get to Mars in half the time, risking an explosion that will set off an electromagnetic pulse that will, oops, destroy the grid back on Earth. Or a sweet dreams bedside nuclear explosion bomb mushroom cloud lamp, featuring the image of that mushroom cloud right in the middle of Manhattan that seems to leave all buildings intact. But even with all that tempting numbnutsery, I'm afraid I have to go with a story in the San Luis Obispo Tribune entitled, "Demolishing Diablo Canyon Will Have Significant Impacts on the Environment." Say what? Oh, they're not talking about the continued operation of the nuclear reactors as having significant impacts on the environment, despite the fact that they are built atop earthquake faults. This is about the damage to our poor environment that will take place if we dare to move forward with decommissioning. Of course, the sole source in this article is Maureen Zawlik, Pacific Gas and Electric's Vice President of Nuclear Generation Business and Technical Services. She offers that the eventual decommissioning of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant in coastal San Luis Obispo County will have potentially, quote, significant and unavoidable, end quote, environmental impacts. This according to a new draft environmental impact report, which analyzed how decommissioning and dismantling the power plant will affect the ocean and land ecosystems around it. Nothing here about how the continued operation of these two nuclear reactors will impact the local biosphere, and it definitely skirts the issue that this thing is going to have to be decommissioned and dismantled anyway at some point. Why keep it running for another 20 years with the attendant risks in operation, greater quantity of high-level radioactive waste, and who knows what other problems can show up in 20 years? Diablo Canyon's decommissioning and demolition is inevitable, so why wait? Oh, wait a minute. Money! California Governor Gavin Newsom, who seems to be gathering a war chest for a run at the presidency in 2028, last September allowed for the allocation of $1.4 billion in a forgivable loan to PG&E to help fund continued operations at Diablo Canyon. I wouldn't mind a forgivable loan to help run Nuclear Hot Seat. Suddenly, Pacific Gas and Electric is all eco-concerned, citing decommissioning's potential impact on marine life in the Diablo Cove adjacent to the plant, citing potential damage to kelp, algae, turtles, sea otters, seals, sharks, and abalone. PG&E even provided the newspaper with a picture of a leopard shark swimming alongside other fish in Diablo Cove. It's all spin and hooey from a newspaper known to be super, super, super pro-nuclear and unafraid to publish obviously skewed articles as though they are the facts of the matter. And that's why, over and above the lamp and nukes in space, Pacific Gas and Electric and San Luis Obispo Tribune, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numb Nuts of the Week.
Regarding Japan's planned release of 1.3 million tons of radioactive water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, there is now a call out of China to take this case to the UN General Assembly. Meanwhile, in a move that could create further diplomatic headaches for Prime Minister Fumio Kishida of Japan, China has begun testing all seafood imports from Japan for radiation. And there have been cases where some Japanese seafood exports are being held up by Chinese customs. Hong Kong has also started strengthening radiation inspections of seafood imports from Japan. Hong Kong is Japan's second largest market for agricultural and fisheries exports from Japan, while mainland China is the biggest and has been among the most vocal in its opposition to the plan to dump the radioactive water into the Pacific, accusing Japan of treating the Pacific Ocean as its private sewer. The Pacific Islands nations, having been used for nuclear tests and dumping by the U.S. and France, deeply oppose Japan's plan and see it as a nuclear legacy issue. The Pacific Collective on Nuclear Issues, made up of civil society groups and NGOs, has asked Japan to explain its disregard for the findings of the independent Pacific Expert Panel, and why instead it chose to use the International Atomic Energy Agency's report to justify the ocean dumping of nuclear waste. The collective issued a statement that said, "We do not feel assured by the IAEA's confidence in the safety of Japan's proposal, as the agency's remit is promoting the safe use of nuclear energy." And a reminder that radioactive cesium 180 times Japan's legal maximum has been found in a fish caught in the port of the remains of the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. Cesium in the black rock fish measured 18,000 becquerels per kilogram. The legal limit under the Food Sanitation Act of Japan is 100 becquerels per kilogram. In the United States, the legal limit is 1,200 becquerels per kilogram, meaning that food that is 12 times too radioactive to be sold in Japan is perfectly legal to import to the United States and sell here without labeling or warning. And Fukushima mothers are still taking their radioactive watchdog role seriously by doing their all testing of fish, seafood, homegrown vegetables, rice, and soil brought in by citizens concerned about radioactive contamination. The group is called the Mother's Radiation Lab Fukushima, or Tarachine, which means mother or someone who fights to protect her children. In Ukraine, the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed that Russian forces occupying the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant have placed explosive mines near the facility. The mines were located in a buffer zone between the plant's internal and external boundaries. The IAEA Director General, Rafael Grossi, said, "Having such explosives on the site is inconsistent with the IAEA safety standards and nuclear security guidance and creates additional psychological pressure on plant staff." Ukrainian Energy Minister Galushenko said, "It might blow up at any moment. We just don't know when. Russia has completely cut us off from the safety monitoring systems." An ongoing situation is that on June 23rd, the Russians kidnapped Zaporizhia occupational safety engineer Sergei Potnya and is reported by EnergoAtom to be torturing him. And former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev claimed Russia would have no choice but to deploy nuclear weapons if the Ukrainian counteroffensive was successful. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, this week marks the anniversaries of the United States dropping atomic bombs on Japan. First Hiroshima on August 6th, then Nagasaki on August 9th. That means it's busy season for nuclear interests to plant well-honed and focus-grouped stories about the marvels of nuclear everything, why we need more and more powerful nuclear weapons, how we cannot feel safe as a nation without the ability to blow up the entire world at the push of a button. Pro-nuclear spin doctors are interpreting the Oppenheimer film as justification for nuclear weapons, not a warning against them. And even as downwinders from minority and marginalized populations are finally getting a bit of media recognition for their ongoing issues, the danger is that the moment will pass and the country will go back to its institutionalized nuclear amnesia about the environmental racism underlying so many nuclear contamination decisions. That is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we get into nuclear stories with facts, continuity, and context, as well as a healthy dose of skepticism, providing a much deeper and nuanced telling than you could ever expect to find on mainstream media. But to keep doing this work, we need your help. This show runs on donations, and we're always in need of support. A one-time tax-deductible donation of any amount? Splendid. How about a recurring donation? Say, $5 a month, the same as you would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee and a tip to the barista. Be it one-time or ongoing, any donation you make in any amount all counts towards our monthly nut. And because we're a 501c3 nonprofit, your donation is deductible. So go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send to info@nuclearhotseat.com and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Hibakusha, which looks like hibakusha, is the term for those who survived the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But in recent years, it has come to be applied more widely to all who have been exposed to radiation from nuclear bombs and other sources of contamination from manufacturing, uranium mining, nuclear reactors, and radioactive waste. As today's guest will explain, that means just about all of us. Professor Robert Beau Jacobs is an American historian of nuclear technologies and radiation technopolitics. He moved to Japan in 2006 after being hired by the Hiroshima Peace Institute and is currently a professor at the Hiroshima Peace Institute and the Graduate School of Peace Studies of Hiroshima City University. He's also the author of the 2022 book Nuclear Bodies, The Global Hibakusha. And that's the basis of what we're going to be talking about. Beau has such a wealth of information to share that our interview ran well over 1 hour. So it's being presented in two parts as a bracket around the anniversaries of the U.S. bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. To clear up a few references that appear, note that in part one, Rongelap is in the Marshall Islands and was site of the U.S. A-bomb tests in the 1950s. And the Japanese fishermen on the boat Lucky Dragon were accidentally contaminated by nuclear fallout from the United States' Castle Bravo thermonuclear weapons test at Bikini Atoll in 1954. I spoke with Beau Jacobs on Friday, July 21st, 2023. Professor Robert Jacobs, thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with a little bit about you. What is your background and what brought you to this subject material?
In a lot of ways, I've had a non-traditional background in terms of academic work and doing this kind of work in the sense that I had four kids in my 20s. And so I began work on my bachelor's degree when I was 30 years old with four kids. And so I completed my doctorate in my mid-40s and started here at the Hiroshima Peace Institute when I was 45. And so, you know, I came into academia late, having, you know, been working and supporting a family for, you know, 25 years. So it's not a traditional academic route. And this has been the only place I've ever worked in academia is here at the Hiroshima Peace Institute. So I kind of had this odd route, ended up in kind of a place I hadn't anticipated being. And this is where I've spent my whole academic career. But in terms of the content and the topic, it's actually rooted in my childhood. As a child of the Cold War, I was taught how to prepare for nuclear attack in the 60s when I was in elementary school in suburban Chicago. And one of the things they told us was you always have to anticipate the flash, because that's your first sign that the bomb has detonated. And then you do whatever they pretended you could do, duck and cover, get under a table, whatever you might supposedly do. And so I remember getting this training when I was 8 years old and going home and sitting on the front steps of my house and just anticipating, like waiting for the flash, like being vigilant, like waiting for the flash. And I had this sudden sense of my house and the school across the street just dissolving, and it just terrified me. And, you know, I've often thought that that was sort of becoming aware of my own mortality, but it was really connected with nuclear weapons. And so I was so afraid of nuclear weapons that my coping mechanism for it was to read about it and learn about it. And so in the next few years, what that meant was like biographies. That's sort of what there was to read when I was a kid. So I read about Harry Truman, Robert Oppenheimer, all of these people, and the Manhattan Project. And in a sense, I've just never stopped reading about it in order to comfort myself or at least steel myself for the reality of these things.
I have much the same background, having come from the same era and the same history. Explain to us, what is the Hiroshima Peace Institute?
The Peace Institute is sort of a broadly defined peace institute. It was founded in the late 90s. In a sense, it was part of an early wave of Hiroshima's anxiety over how this memory would be continued once the generation of Hibakusha passed, which is, you know, very much the feeling here in town now. But it was modeled on things like CIPRI and sort of Northern European Peace Institute. Originally, there were people from multiple countries and multiple disciplines working on their specific topics. So we don't focus as an institute collectively, for example, on Hiroshima issues or nuclear issues. There's people that work on war crimes issues, people that work on politics in various regions, people that work on sustainability. So it's kind of a broadly defined peace institute. And I'm one of the people here, one of the handful of people here working directly on nuclear weapons issues. And some of the people working on nuclear weapons issues are working on abolition and security studies, which is sort of the traditional academic home for working on nuclear weapons. But my own work is very much on the other end of the spectrum. It's much more of a bottom-up how people experience nuclear things rather than how policies were set around nuclear things. 10 years ago, our research institute got integrated into Hiroshima City University. So now we're a research faculty of Hiroshima City University. And about 6 years ago, we began a graduate school in peace studies. So our home now is in the Hiroshima City University, but we still are a separate entity within the university.
One of the things that so impressed me about your book, Nuclear Bodies, A Global Hibakusha, is the human aspect you brought to even the most technical discussions. And this is an all-encompassing book. I think it's a reference book that should be on the desk of anybody who opposes nuclear, who wants to know more about it, who's writing about it. You managed to make it humane when you're talking about some of the most horrific things on the face of the planet. And I'm wondering, first of all, what inspired you to take the time and the effort and the energy to write this book?
Well, this book is really, in many ways, the outcome of a dozen years of field research, most of that conducted with my research collaborator, Dr. Mick Broderick from Australia. We began the research on what we call the Global Hibakusha Project in 2010. And especially in the next 8 or 9 years, we did multiple research trips to sites of nuclear contamination. Originally, the way we envisioned the project was that we were going to be gathering oral histories in communities near nuclear test sites. That's what the beginning of it was. And the idea at first was that we would do a non-epidemiological study. Because when you talk about people in the Marshall Islands, Kazakhstan, and many of these locations, whatever academic inquiries there typically were around these sites were epidemiological, like, you know, what kinds of cancers were developed and what percentage of the population. And we were looking at what people experienced and how people lived through this and how it altered their sense of the integrity of their own bodies and their own ecosystems. And so we gathered a lot of oral histories and visited a lot of these sites. And we began to extend that. We did a lot of interviews with so-called nuclear soldiers, people who participated in nuclear tests compelled by their governments of the nuclear weapon states, Americans, Australians, French, Brits, and also laborers who worked at nuclear test sites. So we began to expand out to essentially people who had experienced exposure to contamination, exposure to fallout primarily. And part of why we thought of it as the Global Hibakusha Project was that these histories had been siloed into national histories, like victims of U.S. nuclear testing, victims of U.K. nuclear testing. And we looked at this as sort of a political structure that limited one's sense of the harm. If it was people living in southern Utah downwind from the Nevada test site, well, that's really tragic, obviously, but it was X number of people. But really, when you step back and you look globally at this history as a collective history, because what the people who live near these sites experienced, what the soldiers experienced, what the laborers experienced, was essentially a collective history. I mean, it really didn't matter which country it was that was exposing them to fallout and radiation. You know, their experiences were of a type. So we started to think of this as a global history and this as a global community, so that when you pull back from using nation states to define this history and instead think of it as a collective, because that's how the planet experienced it, you're talking about millions of people. And suddenly you begin to see the scale of harm that was done to so many people. And so as Mick and I were doing this field work, other things came in as well. We began to include other sites, nuclear accident sites. And of course, soon after we began this project, Fukushima happened. And one of the things that was, for me living here in Japan, when Fukushima happened, was watching the kind of discourse of management of nuclear anxiety just kick in again. And people saying, for example, the government saying, well, hopefully there won't be any serious health impacts, and realizing, well, this has never happened without serious health impacts, and they know that. And so this is just a discourse to manage people's uncertainty and convince them that things will be okay. So watching the mechanisms of managing anxiety and sort of dismissing people's concerns over health, it began to also focus me a lot on the nature of radioactive fallout, the way people experience it, and the way that it's been kind of minimized in this history. So as well as starting off as kind of a history of exposed communities from Cold War nuclear testing, it sort of broadened into a larger nuclear project. And eventually, because all of this stuff heads in this direction, it began to include waste issues as well.
One of the things that so impressed me about the book was how you seamlessly wove all of these different complex, as you said, siloed subject areas into a cohesive, continuous narrative that did keep the human focus. It weaves together the narrative threads from technology, science, politics, the military, to its impact on the innocent bystanders, who are often indigenous people or people who had absolutely no power in the situation and didn't even know what they were up against until years later, when suddenly there were health consequences. It showed up in the next generation and more information was revealed. How did you determine a means of structuring or weaving this information together into a coherent narrative?
That took a lot of time. It took a lot of time to sort of figure out how to tell this story in a way that didn't make it a bunch of separate stories, you know? And so in a sense, my own training in academically is in history of science and technology. So that sort of gave me a departure point, was that I think it's really important to understand the technological nature of these weapons and of harm from radiation in order to understand how this history operated, both physically and also politically. But spending this time, spending this dozen years basically immersed in these communities and going from one to another, it began to seem like one story. And so part of what the challenge for me was how to tell it that way. And so it took me quite a while. I wrote the later chapters of the book first, because they were a little bit more self-evident to me. The last chapter, which is about the legacy of nuclear waste, of high-level nuclear waste, that's sort of a standalone chapter, but it's the dumping ground of the whole rest of the book. It all gets dumped into the nuclear waste, of course. Originally, looking at the nuclear test sites, I began to, obviously, the first thing that comes out, as you said, was that the communities that are selected to be irradiated are essentially communities that cannot politically keep this from happening. So test sites are located in colonial, post-colonial places or near ethnic or religious minorities. And so these communities that were selected to have these sites be upwind from them were really each nation that made a choice of where to put the test sites used a similar kind of decision-making, which is, how can we keep this fallout away from people who are important? And so that's another way of saying, who isn't important? That was a fairly straightforward story. That's a chapter called Selecting the Irradiated. To lead up to how we got to those places, to talk about how people are harmed and how ecosystems are harmed by fallout and what the results of fallout deposition into ecosystems is, and then the anxieties that people have, that took a little while to figure out how to structure the first two sections of the book. Essentially, what I came down with once I was really working on the book as a manuscript was that it has to start with describing how people are harmed by radiation and how specifically people are harmed by fallout. And then to talk about how the ecosystem is impacted by fallout, because there's the event of fallout. There's when the fallout comes down and people experience harm. For example, the people in Rongelap and the fishermen on the Lucky Dragon and these communities, the fallout comes down, people are harmed. That's an event that happens at a time. But one of the things that we saw from traveling in nuclear test sites was some people were evacuated from contaminated ecosystems. Other people were left in contaminated ecosystems. And for those communities, you saw far more health impacts on people, third and fourth generation people who were, in a sense, living in contaminated environments. So the way that the risk was ongoing, I felt like I needed to spell out how fallout harms human beings and how fallout moves through the ecosystem once it's deposited. Once having established that, then I could move on to the kinds of anxieties people face when they have this uncertainty, when they're living in contaminated places where the risk is ongoing and the risk for their children is ongoing. So I started with the properties of the risk, the properties of the ecosystem, then what it's like to be a human being in these places. And then from that, how politicians made decisions about who has to endure this and who doesn't have to endure this. And finally, the fact that we are inflicting these decisions on thousands of generations and the people who have no choice through filling their world with our nuclear waste, which is not something we might do, it's something we've already done.
After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was, of course, horror at the fireball, the explosion, the devastation, the number of people who were killed immediately. But then came radiation after that, which had horrific impact starting days, weeks, months afterwards, and then continued, and has now been tracked in the wake of those two explosions. There is something called the lifespan study, which was started after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and is considered to be the gold standard for describing the health impacts of radioactivity, radiation, fallout. But there are limitations to that study. Tell us about that and how it plays out.
That's an essential question and an essential part of how the book makes sense of this history. At the time that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were attacked with nuclear weapons, you know, there had been maybe a few hundred people who had suffered harm from radiation that had been studied. You know, a lot of uranium miners had suffered harm from radiation. But in terms of our models of how radiation causes health problems, there had been a very limited number of people. And suddenly, after the nuclear attacks here in Japan, there were hundreds of thousands of people exposed to radiation. So as historian Susan Lindy has pointed out, this was considered by researchers to be this incredible opportunity to create a database to track the health of all of these hundreds of thousands of people and create a database so that we have a model for how exposure to radiation eventuates in illness and early death. And so this study was begun soon after the occupation began here in Japan in the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission, which was set up by the United States during the occupation to study the Hibakusha. And there were multiple different studies that they did, and they did really pioneering work in a lot of ways. But the study that's become the most important study in terms of the way that it has been used in the years since then is the lifespan study that you mentioned. Lifespan study began in 1950. And the basic idea of the lifespan study is that you take two data points. One, how much radiation was someone exposed to? Two, what illnesses did they develop? How many years later? And did they experience early mortality? And you put this together for 100,000 people and you have a database whereby when someone is exposed to radiation, you can say, okay, you were exposed to this much radiation. So now you have this percentage chance of developing this cancer, this percentage chance of developing that cancer. And you can basically assess what are likely to be the health impacts of radiation exposures. This is the idea of the lifespan study. And so it's a huge database and it's very robust, but there are limitations to it. And this is exactly where this all gets political. When we're exposed to radiation, there's two different ways that we're exposed to radiation, externally and internally. So for example, when a nuclear weapon detonates, there's energy that radiates out from this explosion. You have heat, you have blast, and you have radioactive waves. So all of these are forms of energy that burst from the center of the detonation. They go out here in Hiroshima, they extended out about 3 kilometers in every direction, and they dissipate as they go further out. So blast, you know, destroys things, heat sets things on fire or burns things. And the burst of gamma radiation, the radioactive waves, harms people that are inside of that, say, 3-mile zone away from ground zero. But the gamma waves, the external waves that come through your body from outside of your body, they last less than a minute. So you have to be in that place when the weapon detonates for this radiation to harm you. One way to look at that is that it's like a gigantic X-ray. You know, when you get an X-ray, you're waiting, then the X-ray is turned on, the X-ray is turned off. During the period of time the X-ray is on, there's radiation passing through your body. It makes a photo of your tooth or your bone or whatever it might be. When the X-ray is turned off, there's no more radiation. That's what it's like when the weapon bursts, the gamma waves burst, they pass through everything, they pass through people's entire bodies. If you're close enough to get a large dose, it damages cells, it damages organs, it can cause illness quickly if you get a high dose, it can cause cancers later if you get a lesser dose. And so this is one of the immediate impacts of the detonation of the weapon. But the other is radioactive fallout. And radioactive fallout is particles, it's not waves. It's little pieces of different types of chemical matter that ionize, so they're radioactive. Some of it is material from the weapon itself. Some of it is, for example, here in Hiroshima or in Nagasaki, some of the uranium-235 or the plutonium that didn't fission is just spread out. Some are fission products. These are chemicals that are radioactive chemicals that are created by the process of the nuclear explosion itself. Other material is ionized, it's made radioactive by the explosion. So for example, when you look at a film at the Nevada test site, say, of a mushroom cloud, of a nuclear explosion, what you see is this huge column of material going up into the fireball, rising up into the fireball. It's filling up with particles, and a lot of them are ionized radioactive particles. And this is why there's a mushroom, is this, the top of the cloud is filling up with these particles. So these are radioactive particles, and they stay radioactive. It's not like X-rays or gamma waves. It's not like there's a wave that passes through you for a minute and then it's gone. These are pieces of material that remain radioactive. And as the cloud drifts, these particles fall back down to Earth, and they're dangerous to us, not externally, unless there's a ton of them. They're dangerous to us if we get them inside of our body. And we get them inside of our body through inhaling them or swallowing them in food or water. And then if we get these particles inside of our body looks at them as chemicals. So for example, one radioactive particle, a fallout particle that many people have probably heard of from nuclear testing is strontium-90. There was a lot of anxiety about strontium-90 during the period of atmospheric nuclear testing. Chemically, strontium-90 is similar to calcium. So if you get a particle of it inside of your body goes, oh, calcium. And so it puts it into the bones or into the teeth. This is why strontium-90 is in the teeth. Other particles go to different places. For example, radioactive iodine. When the body gets iodine, the body puts iodine into the thyroid gland. If it happens to be radioiodine, which is iodine-131, it puts it into the thyroid gland. It says iodine. This is what we do with iodine. So the body takes these particles, if you get them inside of you, and it uses them the way that it uses any chemicals that you intake through food and other ways. Now, depending on the particle, it remains radioactive for a different period of time. You know, radioactive iodine for less than a year or two, but strontium-90 for 300 years. And so if this particle is deposited in your body, it's possible for some people, they may pass it out. Like the reason people take iodine pills, if there's a nuclear disaster, is you fill your thyroid up with good iodine. And then if you get, you know, radioactive iodine, your body will flush it because you don't need iodine. If your body hangs on to this particle, though, it gives off a very, very small amount of radiation. If it was outside of your body, it wouldn't really cause much of a risk to you. The level of energy is very low. But if it's inside of your body, it's giving this energy off to the cells around it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And this could be, in the case of strontium-90, for the rest of your life. And so these particles, if internalized, will often also result in cancers, immune disorders, and other diseases. So it's a different form of exposure. Now, why the lifespan study is important is because in 1950, at the time when this study began, it was not possible to figure out if people had particles inside of their bodies or not. And so that was simply left out of the study. It was assumed by scientists at the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission that anybody in Hiroshima or Nagasaki that got particles inside of them also had probably been exposed to a huge amount of external rays as well. So they simply left internal exposure out of the study. And that's fine. It was not science that was possible to do. I don't personally think of this as conspiratorial. I don't think they left it out in a sneaky way. It was just not easy science. It was impossible at the time. So it was excluded from the study. So the study was built on how much external radiation were you exposed to. So the model we have that is used whenever people are exposed to radiation is the lifespan study. As you mentioned, it's the gold standard study. It's what it's always called. So in order to assess if people have risk from radiation, what we do is we measure external levels of gamma radiation. We take a Geiger counter, we measure how much radiation is this person receiving in their body, from outside of their body, from the radiation in the atmosphere. And we say, okay, your risk is related to that amount of radiation. But that's not the way people have been harmed. So in a sense, one way to put it is that our models of harm from radiation that were built in Hiroshima and Nagasaki assumed that in the future, people would experience what people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki experienced, which is they would be exposed to the detonation of nuclear weapons. But that's not what happened. Instead, we had 2,000 nuclear weapon tests and nuclear accidents. And there were very few people close enough to these to receive a giant burst of gamma radiation. What there were millions of people living where the fallout came down. So their risk from radiation is not similar to the risk as people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but we take a medical model built on what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we use that to dismiss their anxieties. For example, after Fukushima, the only people exposed to high levels of gamma radiation were the people in the plants where the meltdowns happened. But there were four explosions which carried a lot of particles downwind and contaminated an area primarily to the northwest. We've all seen these contamination maps in Fukushima. Those people are living where particles came down. So you can hold a Geiger counter up, and the Geiger counter can show a low level of radioactive exposure. And using the lifespan study, we can say, oh, this level of radiation is so low, there will be no health problems from it. But that's not the way that people are experiencing the harm. The way they're experiencing the harm is they're getting particles inside of their body. And because these particles came down in forests, these particles came down in rice fields, these particles came down across an entire ecosystem, once those particles deposit in the ecosystem, they move through the ecosystem, they transport through the ecosystem. And so the people who live in those areas are much more likely to experience harm by eating food, or drinking water, or somehow getting particles inside of themselves, sometimes years later. And the lifespan study tells us nothing about those risks. It tells us nothing about the harm that's done when that happens, But it is the tool we use to dismiss people's anxieties about radiation. Now, I don't think the study is a bad study. It's just used badly. Instead of saying, according to the lifespan study, you will have no harm from radiation, what should be said at test sites, what should be said at Chernobyl, what should be said at Fukushima is, according to the lifespan study, you are not at high risk of disease from external levels of radiation. However, there are a lot of radioactive particles distributed into the ecosystem, and you are at risk of illness from these particles. And we can't tell you whether that risk is high or low because it's really widely distributed and unevenly distributed. So that's the truth about the risk that people face in test sites, in Fukushima, in Chernobyl. But that's not what they get told. What they get told is, according to the lifespan study, you have nothing to worry about. And so when people develop illnesses later and they say this is related to the radiation, when whole communities are experiencing higher levels, then it will be said, well, it's a lifestyle thing. Some people smoke. Maybe your diet's not good. And internalized cancers and immune disorders that eventuate from internalized particles take longer to present than cancers from being exposed to a high level of external radiation. So 20 years later, it gets dismissed.
Professor Robert Bo Jacobs. He is an American historian of nuclear technologies and radiation technopolitics, currently at the Hiroshima Peace Institute, and he is also author of the 2022 book, Nuclear Bodies, the Global Hibakusha. We covered so much ground in our interview, as I said before, there was no way to fit it into a single nuclear hot seat. So you can hear the conclusion of our interview on next week's show, Nuclear Hot Seat number 633. In the meantime, we will have links up to Bo's book and his website, bojacobs.net, on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 632.
Activists, shout out.
Here's an exercise anyone interested in nuclear bombs and their impact can do, and it's kind of fun in an apocalyptic end-of-the-world kind of way. Now that we're marking the anniversaries of the United States atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's time to ask yourself, what might an atomic bomb do to my neighborhood, city, state, country? Well, it's easy enough to find out. Just go to NukeMap. Historian Alex Wellerstein created NukeMap as a do-it-yourself way to launch a nuclear war on, well, anyone, anywhere, all over the world. You enter the name of the city or country you wish to see nuked, pick out the size of the bomb being dropped, check off a few more boxes, et voila! A map showing the target as well as the range of impact from the blast will pop up almost immediately, showing everything from instantaneously vaporized to, merely killed, or, well, you're still alive, but you won't be a month from now. I suggest you start with the preset for Little Boy, the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, and use it to translate the photos that you've seen of what happened on the ground there onto your neighborhood. Now, as of this recording, there are currently some issues in calculating the number of casualties. You used to be able to see it flip over like a really fast odometer, but it stopped working a few days ago. Feel free to be as paranoid about this as you like. But Alex Wellerstein has posted on the site that he's working on it, and it should be up and running soon. Meanwhile, consider the blast and burn concentric circles, read the definition of what each means, and realize this could be any one of us anywhere. It's good motivation to get even the most nuke-loving among us to pause, think, and perhaps change their minds. As I've mentioned earlier, right now is the hot time of year for stories about nuclear. Every year with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we get inundated with a wave of articles. And this year, the impact is magnified and multiplied because of the attention being paid to the Oppenheimer film. But there's been a shift this year, as downwinders and Native people have been finding a place for their voice to be put out and be heard. Most notably among these is an excellent op-ed by downwinder and activist Tina Cordova It's in the New York Times and is entitled, What Oppenheimer Doesn't Tell You About the Trinity Test. Tina's article is already being cited in other news articles and editorials and is well worth the read. It's behind a paywall, but shh, we have a link to be able to access it up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 632. These include Oppenheimer and the story behind those who lost their land to the lab. Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists writing, The misguided push to weaken nuclear safety standards is gaining steam. There's a big article in Fortune magazine, hardly a bastion of far-left thinking. It's entitled, There's No Such Thing as a New Nuclear Golden Age, Just Old Industry Hands Trying to Make a Buck. Rebecca Solnit issues a warning, We can't afford to be climate doomers. Former head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Allison McFarlane, weighs in with the end of Oppenheimer's energy dream. Modular reactors are supported by ideology alone. To which we must add, and a lot of really slick nuclear industry PowerPoint presentations. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists posted Bombs Away, Confronting the Deployment of Nuclear Weapons in Non-Nuclear Weapon Countries. We're going to have an interview about that in August. And a really juicy article, The Profiteers of Armageddon, Oppenheimer and the Birth of the Nuclear Industrial Complex. All of those and more will be posted with links on the Nuclear Hot Seat website, nuclearhotseat.com, and it's this episode, number 632. And a reminder that there are some easy, free ways for you to support us. You can go to nuclearhotseat.com and sign up in the yellow opt-in box to get one episode a week. That's all. You'll get the link and a short description of some of the content. Google's algorithms love it when we show a robust database. Alternatively, go to Nuclear Hot Seat on Facebook, and while you get the download for the episode, you can click follow, like, and then forward the link to two people you think would be interested in learning more. We're real grassroots around here, and we rely on you to help us out. So do what you can to share the show with others in this Oppenheimer-intense environment. And you can also sign up on any of your favorite podcast platforms, because we're there too. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 1st, 2023. A lot of the best stories I get to cover come because listeners on the front lines of some nuclear something or another in your area point me to it and suggest people. So, if you see something, if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send it to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help and appreciate your support. Anything and everything helps. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. This is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that it was Pope Francis who said, Nuclear weapons exist in the service of a mentality of fear that affects not only the parties in conflict, but the entire human race. There you go. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.